Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Every Sunday morning at 9, join me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM. Each week we'll be exploring the wonderful world of modern jazz. From hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz, Sunday mornings at 9 on Sheffield Live.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, Bluegrass, American Roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best in new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Good morning, welcome to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every week, 11 until 12 on a Saturday morning. Got Julian Paul here live. We'll be speaking to RPG later in the show. It's a bit of an unusual show today because we've got no Gareth Morgan. He's off on his travels. But never mind, there is a Photographic Union exhibition. It's a Yorkshire Photographic Union annual exhibition at the Denham Gallery, Library and Museum in Doncaster. That runs until Saturday, the 5th of July. So if you want a bit to go and see a bit of what Sheffield Photographic Society does, go and check that out. There's hundreds of photographs from photographic clubs across Yorkshire, of course, and including Sheffield Photographic Society. You can also check out Sheffield Photographic Society on www.sheffieldphotosociety.org.uk. They're also pretty active on Instagram and Facebook, yes. And well worth following them because they put up some cracking photographs. And also a reminder that Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society will have a stall at Wentworth Village Day on Sunday the 6th of July. They'll be there from 10 o'clock till 4 on the Wentworth Village Fields, and they will have a stall there with safe filtered telescopes so you can view the sun safely. And on that note, it is Saturday the 21st of June 2025. That can mean only one thing. It's a summer solstice. Interesting. We'll be talking about that very shortly. In fact, right now. Here we go.
And let's kick off very slowly on this because it's a bit complicated. The summer solstice.
Our Earth rotates on its axis once each day, producing the cycle of day and night. At the same time, the Earth moves around the Sun on its orbit over the course of a year. However, the axis of rotation of the Earth is not lined up with the axis of motion around the Sun. Instead, it is tilted slightly at 23.44 degrees. This tilt means that during one half of the year, the north side of the Earth is tilted slightly towards the Sun and the south is tilted away. For the other half of the year, the reverse is true. The summer solstice occurs when one of Earth's poles, north or south, has its maximum tilt towards the Sun. It happens twice yearly, once in each hemisphere, northern and southern, during that hemisphere's summer. At the exact moment that the northern hemisphere is most tilted towards the Sun, the northern hemisphere experiences its summer solstice. The southern hemisphere, by contrast, has its winter solstice. On the summer solstice, Earth's maximum axial tilt towards the Sun is 23.44 degrees, and likewise, the Sun's declination from the celestial equator is 23.44 degrees. The summer solstice is therefore the day with the longest period of daylight and shortest night of the year, when the Sun is at its highest position in the sky. At either pole, there is continuous daylight at the time of its summer solstice. The opposite occurs at the winter solstice, when there is continuous darkness at either pole.
You sound like Phil Moffat from the Mexican Winter Astronomical Society. He'd be doing this off the top of his head. But anyway, in the Northern Hemisphere, that's us. The summer solstice is the June solstice, and it's today, the 21st of June 2025, just in case you're listening on catch-up. And the winter solstice for us is the December solstice, so that falls this year on the 21st of December 2025. And the dates that those two fall on are very similar. There's not much difference each year. In the Southern Hemisphere, so think New Zealand and Australia. I've got family friends there, so they're in their winter at the minute, which seems bizarre. The winter solstice is today, and for them, their summer solstice is in December, so it's a complete reversal. So since prehistory, the summer solstice has been a significant time of year in many cultures, and has been marked by festivals and rituals. Traditionally, in temperate regions, especially in Europe, the summer solstice is seen as the middle of summer and referred to as midsummer, although today in some countries and calendars, it is seen as the beginning of summer. Some might say we've had summer for months up to now. Yes. And although the summer solstice is the longest day of the year for whatever hemisphere it's in, the dates of early sunrise and latest sunset vary by a few days. This is because Earth orbits the Sun in an ellipse and its orbital speed varies slightly during the year. If you tune in regularly, you'll know that RPG said we've extracted so much water from the Earth that actually it tilts slightly more now. Amazing. And so summer and winter solstices are key points in the year, along with the spring and autumnal equinoxes, which help to determine the seasons on Earth. Earlier this year, we talked about those, particularly the spring equinox. So at two points in the year, the Sun will illuminate the northern and southern hemispheres equally. These are known as the vernal or spring equinox and the autumnal equinox. On these dates, there are approximately equal hours of daylight and darkness. So in the northern hemisphere, that's us, the vernal or spring equinox occurred in March this year, so that was 20th of March 2025, and it marked the beginning of spring. The autumn equinox for us this year will occur in September, 22nd of September 2025 to be precise, and that marks the beginning of autumn in the southern hemisphere for us. But in the southern hemisphere, it's all the opposite way around. How interesting.
We'll be right back.
cracking track there by Joe Satriani, the summer song. We have played that on Glory Days Rock Show, and we'll be playing it again, no doubt. And we played that because it's the summer solstice today, Saturday the 21st of June 2025, if you're listening on Catch Up. And you're, of course, listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure, maybe even share them around. This show is all about science in all its different forms, and quite a lot of cool music as well. And we're here every Saturday morning live from 11 till 12. We're based in the Weir Station on Paternoster Row, if you know where that is. Next up, I saw this article in a Round Town magazine, which I think it covers Barnsley and Doncaster. I saw it in the dentist surgery. Apologies to dentist. I thought I'll just take this as a clipping because I thought it was so interesting. The article, small article, it said Nature Counts. It was a record year for wildlife sightings in 2024-25, according to the Sheffield and Rotherham Wildlife Trust. They received 7,626 wildlife records covering 666 species during the financial year through their Nature Counts data collection system. Apologies if you can hear our aircon, but it is rather warm on this. I think it's the warmest day of the year so far. But we need to have it on because it is a bit hot. Anyway, the Nature Counts data collection system of the Sheffield and Rotherham Wildlife Trust enables the charity to track the state of local nature, monitor wildlife and support conservation efforts. The public can submit wildlife observations if they spot a bird, animal or insect in their local area. But data is also collected from surveys, conservation partners and chance sightings by their staff and volunteers on site. The Sheffield and Rotherham Wildlife Trust manages 15 nature reserves, including Blackamoor, Wyoming Brook, Greno Woods, Centenary Riverside and Kilnhurst Ings. By using the Nature Counts system, the Trust is turning these observations into valuable knowledge that benefits both wildlife and people. Every record helps them paint a clearer picture of what's happening in nature. Are some species doing better or worse, or are there any habitats that are changing? The data shows that there was a reduction in the diversity of species recorded last year, with 121 fewer species compared with figures from 2023-24. The data guides the Sheffield and Rotherham Wildlife Trust team on how to manage their nature reserves and protect wildlife. Recent conservation projects include the delivery of a natural flood risk management scheme on the Rother and recording the return of otters along the River Don, can you believe? You can support the charity in their work towards a better future for wildlife by recording your sightings on their Nature Counts platform. Whether you're spotting birds in your garden, counting butterflies in a park, or volunteering on a survey, your data can make a difference. You can check all this out on wildsheffield.com, and that's the website of Sheffield and Rotherham Wildlife Trust. Great job by Around Town magazine, Barnsley Doncaster, for that article. And apologies to my dentist, or Paul's dentist, who's got one magazine now with a slightly missing article.
I don't need your heaven.
Bow wow wow, there go, wild in the country. And that's because we were talking about the Sheffield and Rotherham Wildlife Trust and Nature Counts. Get involved, check out their website. Of course, listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Talk about science in all its different forms every Saturday, 11 until 12. I saw this in the press last weekend. I thought it was cracking. It's called a kid's quiz, but actually I thought it was rather interesting. So how long have alligators existed for? The answer is, can you believe, for more than 150 million years, since when dinosaurs were still around. Dinosaurs became extinct, but alligators survived. Scientists aren't sure how. Another one, why do you laugh when you get tickled? The answer is, tickling activates part of your brain called the hypothalamus, the same bit that reacts to surprise or danger. It's thought to be a defense mechanism from our ancestors. That's why you laugh, even if it feels a bit weird or you don't like it. And the other one is, why do bees like the color purple? And I thought this was a cracking one. This is what caught my eye, really. Purple flowers often have the most nectar. Bees can't see red, but they have enhanced UV colour or ultraviolet colour receptors, so are drawn to purple and blue flowers. How interesting. Elsewhere in the science news this week, a lot going on. Firstly, the Environment Agency estimates that England is on track for a daily shortfall in public water supplies of 5 billion litres by 2025. That's equivalent to more than a third of current daily usage, which is about 14 billion litres. The Environment Agency said that a further 1 billion litre daily shortfall is expected to hit industries, including food production and emerging technologies such as artificial intelligence, by the 2050s. That warning came with droughts already declared in Yorkshire and the northwest of England, following what the Met Office says is a warmest and driest spring in more than half a century. The Environment Agency expects 60% of the expected future water deficit to be addressed by water companies managing demand and dramatically reducing leaks. Water companies have already committed to a rollout of millions more smart meters for households and have pledged to cut leakage by 17% in the next 5 years and by 50% by 2050. Some might say that's not fast enough. The remaining 40% would come from boosting water supply, including the building of 10 new reservoirs, 9 desalination plants, which is an interesting one because we are an island surrounded by salt water, and also 7 water recycling schemes, and that's all by 2050.
According to scientists, there is a collective blindness to the scale of the climate and health crisis, and that Europe is ill-equipped to deal with tropical illnesses caused by an increase in extreme weather. Diseases such as dengue, D-E-N-G-U-E, which is caused by mosquitoes, have become more prevalent across southern Europe, with last year marking a new peak for the disease. According to a study in the Lancet Planetary Health Journals, its spread could increase to 5 times the current rate by 2016.
Interesting. Apologies if you can hear the air conditioning, but it is the hottest day of the year, so it is a bit noisy, so apologies for that. Next story, an interesting one, quite close by. A baby beaver has been born in Lincolnshire for the first time in 400 years. A kit, because that's what they call baby beavers, was spotted on CCTV on the 13th of June 2025 at an enclosure in North Lincolnshire, making it the first born in the county since they went extinct in Britain in the 16th century. In December 2023, 2 Eurasian beavers were released under licence into a 70-acre enclosure at Wild Rendale near Sear Bay as part of a rewilding project by the farmers Hannah and Jack Dale. And they did that in conjunction with the Beaver Trust and other wildlife organisations. And although only 1 baby beaver has been spotted on CCTV up to now, it's highly likely there are more, as beavers tend to have 2 to 4 kits per litter.
A new nature reserve in the Yorkshire Dales could rejuvenate the area's lost patches of temperate rainforest and provide a haven for wildlife. The project, which will be run by the Yorkshire Wildlife Trust, we'll begin with survey work to ensure that the correct trees are planted and that the areas of limestone grassland that support rare wildfires are able to expand.
And a case of bird flu has been confirmed in poultry in West Yorkshire. The virus was discovered at a site near Ravensthorpe near Murfield on the 11th of June, according to the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, or DEFRA for short. An almost 2 mile or 3 kilometre protection zone and a 6 mile, which is almost 10 kilometres, surveillance zone cordon have been put in place around the premises. DEFRA said all the birds at the property would be humanely culled. It is the latest outbreak in the county of the highly pathogenic avian influenza, which is known as HPAI, and it's the H5N1 virus. Not good news.
The UK is planning to operate its electricity grid without gas for trial periods this summer in a step forward for net zero. The National Energy System Operator has unveiled its scheme to use only wind, solar, nuclear, battery storage and imported power for 30-minute intervals.
All interesting stuff. And just something I'm going to quickly mention before I finish off with a couple of things about electric vehicles and a super seatbelt. And that's there was a documentary on Thursday night about Heston Blumenthal, a very famous chef, crazy chef, known for his snail porridge and things. Well, he did a documentary about his bipolar, his illness, that he didn't really realise he had until relatively recently. But the most interesting thing was, before it was broadcast on TV, it was released as part of the Sheffield Doc Fest, which is ongoing at the minute in Sheffield. And I thought that was a cracking thing to do. And it's raising awareness of mental illness. So it's an important one. So go and catch that if you can. As I said, the government has announced an expansion of local electric vehicle charging points across the UK and streamline the process for installing them in a move designed to accelerate the transition away from fossil fuels. More than 100,000 new charging points will be rolled out in the coming years. And the final story, I saw this the other week. It's an absolute, well, it's very, very interesting, really. A new super seatbelt will use real-time data and adapt depending upon traffic conditions and the person wearing it. In the biggest development since the three-point seatbelt was launched in 1959. And if you remember when the seatbelt came in, that was a game changer in terms of safety. Some people didn't like it at the time, but the world's a very different place now. This new super seatbelt will also monitor other variables such as the height, weight and posture of the person wearing it. This will allow it to pre-tension itself to the optimum amount, shielding the driver and passengers in major crashes while avoiding injury in more minor scrapes. It has been designed by Volvo, the Swedish car manufacturer, which was responsible for the original three-point seatbelt, and that new super seatbelt will debut in the upcoming Volvo EX60 exhibition in 2026. Great song, that as well. That was caused by Gary Numan. Came off his debut solo album back in 1979, can you believe? We played that because we were talking about the new super seatbelt that Volvo will demo, basically, at the EX60 in 2026. You're, of course, listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. On digital, if you're in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org, we're every Saturday morning live talking about science in all its different forms and playing great music as well. You've got Julian Paul here live, all being well. We'll be speaking to RPG later in the show. We're just trying to track him down wherever he is. He could be on a tram, who knows. Next up, this is a story I saw in the press a few months ago, actually. I've never got around to talking about it, but it's an interesting one. Wood-burning stoves to be allowed in new homes. So wood-burning stoves will be allowed in newly built homes in England. The government has confirmed, after lots of speculation, that the appliances could actually be banned. The Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government confirmed the decision in response to a letter from the Stove Industry Association. I never knew that existed, but it's the SIA. That trade body sought to highlight what it described as the significant benefits of modern wood-burning stoves, including their role in reducing carbon emissions, alleviating energy system strain, improving air quality, and promoting sustainable energy solutions. In its response, which was released by the Stove Industry Association a few weeks ago, the government said that it was working towards setting a new standard, which will be called the Future Home Standard, and will ensure its new homes are zero carbon ready, meaning they will need no retrofitting to become zero carbon in use as the electricity grid decarbonises. A full technical consultation on the Future Home Standard was launched in December 2023 and closed in March 2024. Under the standards proposed in the consultation, a wood-burning stove would be permitted as a secondary heating source in new homes. The government acknowledges it's possible to significantly reduce the level of smoke emitted through domestic burning if the right fuels, appliances and practices are used. Andy Hill, who's the chairman of the Stove Industry Association, or SIA, said, "We are delighted it has been officially confirmed that under the proposed Future Home Standard, the installation of a wood-burning stove will be permitted. Responsible use..." And this is the word, responsible use of modern wood-burning appliances is something the Stove Industry Association and its members have advocated for over many years. Andy Hill added, the SIA welcomes the government's positive response and looks forward to continued engagement as policies are developed. We believe that modern wood-burning stoves can play a crucial role in achieving cleaner air, supporting local economies and providing consumers with sustainable and flexible heating choices. Scientific evidence has often pointed to the risks of air pollution being produced by wood-burning stoves, cars and factories indeed, something Dr. Ogo Osamor comes onto this show and talks about every so often. A report published in December 2022 by Sir Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, estimated that wood burners were up to 3,700 times more polluting than gas heating, and even eco-design wood-burning stoves produced 450 times more toxic air pollution than gas central heating. However, the Stove Industry Association claims that a modern eco-design compliant stove releases up to 90% less emissions than an open fire and up to 80% less than some older stoves. It's a very interesting article, that, about wood-burning stoves to be allowed in new homes.
That it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
The time to hesitate is through. No time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. And our love become a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. Thank you.
cracking track there. Light My Fire by The Doors. And we play that because wood-burning stoves are to be allowed in new homes, so says the UK government after a lot of controversy. Very interesting. Of course, you listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 until 12. No sign of RPG. We don't know what's happened to him, but we've got Martin in the studio because it's cool in here, Martin, isn't it?
I've come in here.
It's coming early.
Just relief from the heat.
Just relief from the heat. And to listen to us witter on about fighting fast fashion with clothes that grow with your babies. Once again, apologies for the aircon, but it is rather hot today. It is the summer solstice, and I believe the hottest day of the year up to now. So this article I read quite a while back, actually. Science graduates are coming up with eco-friendly designs that can expand as a child gets older and stop us throwing away so much. And that was an article by Ben Spencer back in March, and it was written for the Sunday Times. It's a problem that parents of small children know well. Almost as soon as you've bought an item of clothing, they've grown out of it. Children grow 7 sizes in their first 2 years, says Ryan Mario Yassin, who's age 31. There is so much waste. Now, Yassin is an aeronautical engineering graduate from Imperial College London, and he's one of a number of scientists, designers and entrepreneurs attempting to tackle the astronomical waste generated by the fashion industry. Imperial College London's White City campus in West London, which provides resources for startups, is becoming a hub of sustainable fashion solutions. Appropriately, it is a short walk from Westfield, London, Europe's biggest shopping centre. Yeah, indeed, we've all got a part to play in all this, you know. And the clothing sector is one of the biggest polluters, responsible for up to 10% of global carbon emissions, which is actually more than aviation and shipping combined, according to the United Nations.
Wow.
In the United Kingdom, get this, each of us throws away an average of 35 unwanted garments and other textiles every year. And that's according to the environmental charity called RAP. Now, Yassin, who's the aeronautical engineering graduate from Imperial College London, discovered the scale of the problem when he sent clothes to his newborn nephew, Viggo, now age 7. And he said by the time they arrived, they didn't fit him. At the time, he was researching how to design satellites to unfold in space. He uses the same principles to design folds into children's clothing, allowing garments to expand as a child grows older. His company, called Petit Plis, which has shops in Battersea, southwest London and Paris, has sold 30,000 items since 2019. The whole point of our business is to reduce overconsumption and waste, he says. Now, Alyssa Brunato's startup, Radiant Matter, is tackling the materials that fashion designers use to make clothes that shimmer and sparkle. They create tiny little discs of shiny material, and it's all made from petroleum-based plastics or metals and minerals, according to Alyssa Brunato, who's age 36. Now, her company, Radiant Matter, creates shimmer from cellulose, the most abundant organic compound on Earth. This complex carbohydrate forms the main structural component of plant cell walls, so it can be extracted from readily available items such as wood chip or recycled denim. Her company received support from Imperial College London's Undaunted Accelerator Programme for Green Businesses. Its sustainable biosequins are already getting significant attention. Stella McCartney has used them, including for a jumpsuit worn by Cara Delevingne for a Vogue photo shoot. Who says sustainability can't be sexy, says Stella McCartney. The vast majority of the fibres used to make clothing come from one or two sources. Either natural textiles, such as cotton or wool, which require land to be cleared, And trees to be cut down, or petroleum-based synthetics, such as nylon or polyester, which emit greenhouse gases when they are made and release microplastics when they break down. So Selena Materials, another Imperial College London spin-out with labs at White City, as a third solution, biodegradable proteins produced through fermentation. I mean, it's amazing stuff. The company uses artificial intelligence to design bespoke proteins that can be spun into material possessing almost any attribute a clothes manufacturer could desire. We can make fibres tougher than Kevlar, which is a strong heat-resistant synthetic fabric, but comfortable and wearable on the skin. And that is according to James MacDonald, age 45, a physicist and co-founder of that company, Selena Materials. Now, while many companies are trying to make existing processes more sustainable, we've eliminated those processes entirely, and the materials are biodegradable. Selena recently completed a £5.1 million seed-funded round to scale up production and is in talks with fashion brands in Europe and America. Another one, Ponder, another startup founded by four Imperial College London students studying innovation, design, engineering, set out to make a more sustainable version of insulated jackets and duvets. They are usually filled with either feathers and down from ducks and geese, or synthetic material made from plasticky polymers. But the company Ponder, which they've called, they've come up with a solution to that called BioPuff. And it's fluffy. It's made from fluffy seed heads of bulrushes, which grow in marshy ground. This month, or actually this was back in March, so apologies for that. Back in spring, the outdoor brand Berghaus unveiled a jacket that uses that BioPuff material. Their life cycle analysis suggests that BioPuff is less impactful in terms of carbon emissions than goose down and polyester fillers. The plants can also be grown in water, providing a commercial use for re-wetted peatlands, vastly reducing land emissions. I thought that was an incredibly interesting story about fighting fast fashion with various things, and it's all comes out of work done by Imperial College London and the funding they give to young researchers and engineers coming through. Fantastic stuff, eh?
We'll be right back.
Oh, a really nice track, that, Dress to Kill. By Fashion, we might be playing that on Soul Plus soon. Of course, this is the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. It's very hot in here this morning, so we have got the aircon on. Apologies if you can hear that. Eventually, we found Paul Gregory. He'd forgotten it was Saturday. Thought it was Friday. I think the sun has gone to his head. Hopefully, he's on the line.
Science.
Good morning, PG. Good morning.
Eventually.
Good grief. Dear. Blimey. So it's the summer solstice. Has it gone? Is it affected you in a strange way, sun coming up early?
It got very early.
Yes.
So I kind of wandered outside with a cat.
You can get locked up for that, Paul. You see,
it's Friday.
Yeah, it's not Friday, it's Saturday. Never mind, you've lost a day. But so what's caught, you've got about 8 minutes, Paul. What's caught your eye in the science news this week then?
Okay, well, one thing on the fashion front is banana skins.
Ah.
And there's a lot of work going on to try and make pleather, the false leather, with banana skins. So I think a lot of plant materials are being investigated. And don't forget, things like linen come from a plant.
Yeah, flax, isn't it? Are you there, Paul? Are you sat in the garden? Admit it.
No, I'm sat in the house because I'm left. Which is why I was there.
Your signal's a bit murky.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear, you'll have to move near a window.
Yeah, I'll wander around a bit.
So, but going back to banana skins, I mean, people have been making stuff from mushroom fibre, leather from mushroom fibre, yeah.
Yeah, and they're adding mushroom spores into concrete to make it self-healing. So that's one of the things we've covered over time.
Yeah, but, it's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, sort of amazing stuff. I think with what's going on in the world today, I was surprised to hear of a ruling by the Supreme Court in America saying that they have no plan for what to do with their nuclear waste material.
Yeah.
So currently, across the USA, they say they're storing 90,000 tons of spent nuclear materials, and the part of the basis for their ongoing economic activity is to have cheap electricity produced by nuclear power. So it's great. They've got the technology to build the power stations and extract the electricity they want at a cheap price, but the long-term price is building. And, we've talked about that for the UK and what plans there are to encapsulate the nuclear waste in glass and take it down a very deep old mine and store it below the levels that generally people are getting down to. But obviously we also talked about the activity of movement in the Earth's crust. It's a little bit worrying when they're so worried about somebody else having nuclear materials that they haven't really got a plan with what to do to all this nuclear waste.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. We talked about it last week, didn't we, Paul, about Rolls-Royce getting these small reactors.
Well, it's certainly becoming part of our national plan for having that delivery for a base load, not using fossil fuels, so nuclear is coming to the fore. But, like I said, there are some worrying things in the background to that, and I think it's also really quite difficult where you can put things. Because at the moment they're looking at the depths of the ocean, but when they've been looking at that, all of a sudden they're finding new forms of life.
Well, you've got all this Richard Attenborough of the ocean saying we really ought to stop damaging the ocean bed, and I think the government's got a project in Hull actually to dispose of waste under the seabed, and I thought, it's quite at odds with different policies.
it's that old saying, isn't it? Out of sight, out of mind, I think. And that's the worry, I think, with nuclear waste and lots of other kinds of waste. there's an awful lot that needs to be looked into. We've looked at the waterways and our habits, the fashions that cause problems with our water system. But there really is a burgeoning crisis across the world for drinkable water. We talked about that, the amount of potable water, the drinkable stuff to other forms of water. The oceans obviously have got salt, generally speaking. I think fresh water's at a premium. And we're just consuming it in ever-increasing amounts.
You see, well, at the top of the show, we talked about the Environment Agency. They're estimating that England is on track for a daily shortfall in public water supplies of 5 billion litres by 2055 and a further billion litres when you add in industries such as food production and emerging technologies such as artificial intelligence.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean... we've talked about it before with artificial intelligence, the amount of energy that's being consumed. Talked about it with things like cryptocurrency. To mine bitcoins costs an awful lot of energy input. And, there's little bit of a chance of balancing that where the surplus energy out of time, out of sync, basically, with normal consumer demands. But it's just another weight in that growing problem. And, I think it goes well with Blue Planet and everything like that. You know, we've got finite resources on the planet and still not got very close to travelling to another planet in a sustainable way. it does well to look into your own sort of repertoire of things and decide what you can do and decide what's important for you.
Exactly. You know, when I worked in air quality, because obviously Dr. Olga Osimo comes on this show and talks about air pollution and things, he used to say, if everybody does a little bit, it can make a massive difference. You might not think it will. You know, in the same way somebody was telling me the other day about Jeremy Clarkson, his farm, that's been a massive boost for British farmers, and supermarkets have seen a massive upturn in people buying English apples and English strawberries, and does make a difference if everybody does something.
Well, it does, and I think some of that is people being aware, which is exactly the point with Clarkson's farm. Whatever you think about him, it does probably a lot of people's sort of conscience.
And we were in East Yorkshire and talked to somebody, and they said a lot of their friends are farmers, and they love Clarkson, whatever you think of him, for what he's done for the farming industry. Yep. We're going to have to let you go now, Paul, and back to your garden.
Yes. Right, I'll go back and do
bye-bye, Paul. Bye.